This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
It's a good late afternoon. And I say, you really are the survivors, because I know you had a whole day of sitting and listening, and your brains must be pretty saturated by now. I'm not going to talk to you for 40 minutes, you'll be pleased to know. I'm going to frame a conversation or a dialogue that I hope we're going to have together. But I want to say some things first, because you can't shut me up, can you? I want to talk about quality, and the whole frame of the day is about inspection. And really the focus on and purpose of inspection is to make sure that quality services are delivered to young children. And we define quality services really as services that make a difference to children's lives now, the old outcomes agenda. And we know pretty much about what kinds of qualities of service are needed that really impact on children's lives now. And, it's about moving beyond a safe service or a regulated service to a service that really has some kind of magic that can add value to a child's life and give it additionality for them to progress on with something that they wouldn't have had without them, that really does deliver. And I'm looking beyond school readiness or, academic capacity. It's about giving them something that will last a lifetime, because we know the early years, but the first 5 or 6 years of a child's life is when it really, their future possibilities are shaped and formed. So I've called this the golden threads, because what I'm looking for when I'm looking for a service is more than just a satisfactory, safe service that meets requirements. I'm looking for something that has that little bit extra, and I call them the golden threads. And they're golden because they're the things that really weave together to make something very special. And I think that they're the threads that provision has to demonstrate it keeps continually working at. It's not just, yes, I've got this thread in place and that's it, I can forget about it. Quality is only there if you continually revisit it and develop it and make it work for the context and the current group of children that you've got. So good quality, quality for me isn't a line you cross over and it's there. It's a process of ongoing reflection and action, reflection and action. But what are you reflecting on? And that's what I want to keep coming back to. There has been what Margaret Hodge, remember Margaret Hodge, previous minister, some time ago, but really was there when the big investment began in early childhood in our country. And she called it this quiet revolution that was going on. I kept saying to her, why are we being so quiet about it? Why haven't we talked more about it? I mean, the wonderful thing is right now with the new government is they are talking about it, and it is very much there on the agenda, higher than I'd anticipated, or maybe some of you had anticipated. But there has been a revolution, make no bones about it, and I think we will look back historically to England over the last 100 years. You sort of have these markers like the 1944 Act when secondary education, and the 1872 Act when primary education, and I think this last 10 years has been historic, and we did at least begin to put in a proper infrastructure for our under fives that was never there before. It was very, I won't call it a lottery, but a muddle, some very good stuff, but also some pretty poor stuff actually, and very much dependent on where you were and where you lived and who your parents were, according to what you had access to. And a real shift to put in place and to have a national policy on putting really good services together for children and the other revolutionaries and their families. That we don't just talk about children away from the support for parents and the wider family and community. These are big shifts for us in our country. Because that kind of approach where there's a national push has been there in other European countries for many years now. We were out of sync with that, but I think we've got up to speed. And not just, gone from the bottom of the league table, but we're climbing up. We're halfway up. We're not at the top yet, but that's my ambition, is to get us into world-class provision. We have got a significant shift, and it's an international shift, actually. It's not just England. If you look across the developed world, all governments are looking at early intervention because all those arguments are made now. The evidence base, and I guess you've heard about that today, the evidence base is there. Governments can't deny it now. And policy and resources are being diverted, I don't like to say down the system, but to the children and the families at the beginning of lives rather than later interventions that actually cost a lot more, and I'm not going to rehearse that with you. We now have accepted at the highest level that the early years of life, the birth through to compulsory school, and actually the pre-birth bit too, the maternity bit too, how critical that is in terms of shaping life chances and determining. That's the frightening thing, you know, how early on it really is determined. And that investing in that has huge benefits for the whole of society, not just for that child or that family, but it's about a sense of living well in the 21st century and how we support families and local communities to support this next generation and live well themselves. So I do think, too, we have governments that are aware that a lot of progress has been made, and I don't think we should lose sight of the achievements of the sector over the last 10 or 15 years. And I've lived through it, as many of you in this room have. The sector is profoundly different now to what it was, but it's not perfect yet. The capacity is there, the infrastructure in a lot of cases, and we fingers crossed we don't lose that, given you know the difficult challenges in terms of the fiscal situation. But there is an infrastructure there and a cohesiveness there that wasn't there before. But when you look across, and many of you who work out there know that there is some excellent practice out there, but it's not everywhere still. There's still too much variability in terms of what's there. And if we really want to deliver outcomes to all our children that really are going to shape positively their lives, all of our sectors need to keep going with the quality agenda to keep that quality improvement. And it's a continuous process, the continuous quality improvement, which is why I was, you know, I'm working profoundly hard with the Early Years Quality Improvement Support Programme, because I think local authorities have got to sustain that if they can, because many settings have just begun to engage with that journey and they need support to do that, to continue that on. You'll have heard this today. We know that children who experience high quality, and I'm going to be very clear here, cognitively oriented, learning oriented programs, not just care. I wish the language would remove child care away now. We know it's not just about child care. It's about delivering high-quality early learning and development experiences, which, of course, encompass a huge care dimension, but it's much more than just being a place where children are safe and cared for. The context in which they're growing up in these critical years has to be one that's stimulating, rich, challenging, and stretches children's capacity and supports their learning and development needs. In other words, it has a pedagogic orientation. I don't mean a school orientation. And I think it's education, but even if you don't like that word, you know, the rest of Europe uses the concept of pedagogy, which is about human capacity and sustaining and supporting the development of human capacity across all domains of development. And if I was sharp here, I'd be critically saying to you in the early years, it's the personal, social and emotional domains of learning and development and their communication and language development that matters most. Okay? So it's not that I'm not interested in maths or science or music. I adore though, you know, that's very much part of a rich experience. But what is the biggest gift you can give a child is the capacity to be sociable, to be emotionally secure, to have good attitudes and dispositions, and to be able to communicate. And language is, and there, I'm talking about much more than the spoken language, the capacity to communicate is the fundamental way we operate in our worlds. So those are the core things that last a lifetime. And children who experience a context that enables their development in those areas, we know they go on not just to achieve better outcome in schools, but actually go into their young adulthood more likely to make a stable relationship, more likely to be in employment, less likely to have need mental health support, etc., etc., etc. The criminality things come to the extremes. We know that satisfactory provision that just meets minimal standards, doesn't harm children, but doesn't add value to their lives. We know poor quality provision now actually damages it. So the one clear thing is poor quality now has to go. It shouldn't be sustained. It shouldn't be, and I think we've got to get sharper about settings that aren't even meeting the minimal standards, and they're out there, that aren't meeting the welfare standards and the EYFS standards. You know, that's the sharp job first, because those settings where children are damaging their life chances. Those that are, and I think the issue in England is not that there's huge amounts of poor quality, is that there's a lot of okay stuff. That it's, you know, that's not got those magic things that they need to take children on. And I think that's the quality improvement bit. And I think the big message we've got to give to providers out there, that a satisfactory at Ofsted is a starting place, not a finishing line. And that the expectation is that you don't remain satisfactory meeting minimum standards, but that you're moving to good and to outstanding. And Ofsted has a definition of that, which I hope would chime with what I would think about equality. But I'm going to talk to you about what I'd be looking for, and that's evidence-based about what seems to add something extra to a child's life. Interesting, the department acknowledged the evidence base that said there's lots of things, putting in place good quality services that meet all children's needs. It's not a straightforward equation of put in that and then you get to that. It's complex. And there are many factors that are responsible for that. But the evidence says, and the guidance that came out with the EQUIS stuff was quite sharp, is that there are three core areas of work to deliver high quality. And the top one is absolutely right. It's the workforce agenda. In England, we have, relative to other countries that deliver good stuff to their children, we have a low qualification base, and we know it. You know, there is too many poorly qualified and underqualified staff for the job we're expecting them to do. And remember, I'm talking about moving them beyond care, okay? And the training many of them had prepared them for one set of expectations, and we've got another set of expectations now. So we've got a whole workforce development agenda. The key to a good quality are the people that are in there at the front line interacting with those children and families. We know that people with higher levels of qualification, and the EP study has shown that, seem to be able to add something special, and teachers particularly add something special cognitively to children's lives. The evidence is there. So I'm not saying that all people who work with young children have to be teachers, but teachers do make a vital contribution, and the evidence is there, and we mustn't lose sight of that. Graduate leaders, people who intelligently understand how to lead an organisation, different to managing an organisation. You can manage an organisation without leading it. Leadership is about vision, inspiration, taking your team with you, transforming practice, keeping that dynamic going. So leadership work is really important. And our leadership training is getting better, but we've got to give people more access to that. And all the workforce accessing regular continuing professional development, not this view as I've got my qualification, therefore I can stop. All staff continually ought to be engaged in opportunities for continual professional development. By the way, that takes many forms. Good visits are professional development. Work shadowing is good. So it doesn't have to be a course. There's lots of ways to get a culture of professional development, even within a setting with shadowing and leadership and using your team meetings for development opportunities rather than just passing on information about what visitors are coming that week. We know the practice that goes on in these settings is variable, and the worrying thing is the variability is greatest with the youngest children. The embeddingness of the early years foundation stage, particularly in the birth to three arena, we've still got a lot of work to do. Do they really understand that a baby is an active, competent learner and has a brain that needs to be fed and needs that child needs to be continually talked to and lots of opportunities to get that brain capacity up and running? And I'm not talking about hothousing kids here, by the way. The best practice is about being around staff that enjoy being with kids and enjoy their relationship with their children and enjoy engaging with the children. And I keep saying one of the big tasks of leaders, actually, is if you've got people who don't really like being with the kids and don't really enjoy the work, move them on, move them out. We've got to get sharper about that, because staff who don't enjoy children's company and aren't there for the kids, those children are learning all kinds of things from that lack of relationship, or losing all kinds of things from that lack of relationship. So I want staff really to understand from babyhood on that that child is a competent, thriving learner, and their job is to scaffold and plan and support and give that child rich, lively, challenging experiences. Parents' participation in that learning process and seeing that as a partnership, not just we're the professionals, we're going to tell you what you need to be doing, but really the professionals, practitioners working, listening to parents as well as, you know, helping parents and giving them advice. It's a two-way street, that, isn't it? We could spend the whole session on that. A warmth to those relationships, and I do want settings that you walk into and you almost feel it, don't you? It's intangible. But I know whether that setting is welcoming me in or whether that setting is excluding me out. And actually, it starts before they walk through the door. It's about how they're accompanied and enticed to participate and have a sense of place there. And the warmth is part of that. By warm, I don't mean lovey-dovey or soft. I'm talking about, do the parents and the children, the families, feel you deeply care about them, that they matter to you, that you would go that extra mile from? That's what I mean by a warmth. And programmes in that practice that see children as individuals, the whole EYFS is about that unique child. Do you really see and think about your children as unique individuals with their own temperament, their own personality, their own talents, their own skill base, and work with that in an individualised way? Or do you have a programme that's set in some office somewhere else that on this week and this time, and I see programmes like that, this is the activity sheet and this is what we're all going to be doing over, you know, where's the child's individual needs in those kinds of things? How do you, I'm not against having overall strategies, but how do you tailor that for an individual child? That's what a good quality setting does. I'm going to talk more about these things. I like the EYFS very much. I think the sector likes the EYFS very much. I hope the TICAL review is going to affirm the EYFS and the good work that's going on there, and maybe even beef it up a little bit, because there are some bits of it that we need to foreground maybe a little bit more. But the importance of a play-based approach, and I've got a very clear view by that, by what I mean by that. That means that children have a lot of opportunities to take responsibility and to initiate activities and explore in a very open way a context that is rich and full of lots of opportunities. Safety, yeah, but I think maybe the safety agenda's gone too far in some places. We've got obsessed by health and safety and risk assessments. I hope TICAL's going to say something about that too. Because I think you can wrap children up and we manage the risk instead of giving them the opportunity to learn how to manage it themselves. So, five golden threads that we need to be continually evaluating and that I'm hoping that Ofsted would be looking at and encouraging practitioners to reflect on, but which is about delivering outcomes for children. And these aren't my five. They're there in the EQUIS document. And the EQUIS document calls them the non-negotiables. These are things that all settings continually, whether you're a childminder, a creche, a full daycare setting, a school, you should be reflecting and acting and have planning going on to keep reviewing and developing these five areas. What's the L word that's in all of those five? Learning, okay? So it's a pedagogic orientation, not a care orientation. Although for me, learning can't happen if you don't care for those kids, okay? But all of it is about children's learning and development and keeping that at the heart of what we're about here. And then the first one has another L word, which is the leadership of that. I'm going to keep coming back to that. The sector needs leaders, and it needs leaders that understand the learning agenda. And they need to understand that leadership has a skill base and is quite a tough job to do, because you've got to have the capacity to take some risk, take people to places they haven't been before, challenge people, inspire people, motivate people, keep people going. Maybe sometimes unpicking things that went on before and destabilising a bit in order to reconstruct something. Because I think something that's too stable is not good either. Settings should be continually reinventing themselves according to the context and the children that they're dealing with. That's why leadership matters. Secondly, they need to develop a culture in those settings that practitioner learning is at the heart of a profession, that you have to have. I don't get really the gifted amateur bit. I remember a previous government called it a mum's army. You know, I think there are gifted people out there, but training makes a difference. And the knowledge base we have about learning and development is developing all the time. We know so much more about the young brain and how neurologically that develops. That has implications for how we interact and the kind of experience we offer. We know so much more about the importance of outdoors. We know a lot more about why social cohesion matters, or about how emotional attachment is formed or not formed. We've moved on quite a long way from John Bowlby, by the way. Some lovely stuff out there now about how to get those relationships right. How do we access that? You only access that by taking people continually on a professional development journey and getting excited together about the new knowledge and the implications of that for practice. So building that time for reflection and learning for your staff teams is so important. And that's on-site professional development as well as off-site professional development. But underneath that is a culture that has to be led that says, I expect all of you to be open and accessing professional knowledge, that really matters. And I think sometimes we've got this culture that says you don't need skills and competencies, and I don't even worry about qualifications, although that should be there. But it's about a professional approach that says early childhood has a skills base, it has a knowledge base. That knowledge base is deep and challenging and rich and intellectual. And the best kind of practice is informed by intellectual, I mean thinking. People have thought deeply and developed a knowledge base and are good at passing that on. So I'm looking for cultures and settings and leadership that does that. Facilitating partnerships for learning and development is the third thing I'm looking for. And who are your partners? Well, the first partners are the children, because they're in this as well. Are you working with the children as partners in their own learning journey? And I could talk a lot about citizenship and voice and listening to children and giving children agency to shape their days and shape what goes on. Who's with the children? It's the family. I'm going to use parent, but it's a shortcut to that broader context of significant people who are around that child. Parenting comes in all kinds of shapes and sizes in today's society. They're your key partner. So you've got the child, you've got the parents, the family, and you've got this professional base. And together, you're in partnership to support that child who's in the middle of all of that. And is that open and inclusive and respectful of each other? And how do you do that? I think we've got a long way to go to work well with our parents and families, where they really do feel that their knowledge of their child and their values and their cultures and their things are worked with and not against. The other partnerships are around the other services, because none of us operate a service in isolation. Children's centres and extended services, that model of integrated working with our health colleagues profoundly. We've got to open them up and open ourselves up to better partnerships. It's happening, but we've still got a journey to make. But there are other partners too in all this. Local employers, the local community groups, social care people. So together, how do we work in partnership together? How do we work in partnership as the children move through the system? The partnership between where they are when they're two to where they go to at four to where they go to at seven. You know, the partnerships that enable that collaboration to go on. None of us can continue on working in a little bubble of our own world. We have to reach out and work together. It's only when we work together we're going to make a difference. So those partnerships are really important. You see how the leadership is key to steering this through. The environments for learning and development, I'm going to talk or flag three things up here. Number one, the biggest enabling environment is the socio-emotional environment. Not the concrete, the physical environment, but you're sort of bathing children in an ambiance that is warm and welcoming and acknowledging of those individual children and their parents and families, and gives them the sense that they as an individual have a place, have a sense of belonging, a sense of attachment. So those kinds of socio-emotional dynamics that go on in a centre, and that you have a good, what I call a good life together. Because children are living their early lives in these settings. They're there longer hours and younger. So what's the life like for those children? And what's the life like for the staff, the people who are working with those children? How do you make that a good life? Do they, all of them, feel they're a community and each of them have a value and a place and a really critical role to play in that? So that socio-emotional environment, that nurturing environment, and I'm including that for the staff too, because what happens with the staff is modelling what the children feel and receive too. Then there's the physical environment and that indoor environment. By the way, this generation of children is the most indoor-reared generation, like Battery Farm, you know. So let me start with the indoor. If they're there and they're there for long hours, and many of them are, how do we make that environment cosy, comfortable, nurturing, as well as challenging and stimulating? I do worry about an institutionalised generation of children. And I'm looking, the old Susan Isaacs things about a homely environment where you do use, and I think we're getting better at this, soft furnishings, lightings, big places and little cosy places, den buildings where they can tuck their way. It's the most watched generation, by the way, as well. When do they get out of our sight and get up to what we all used to get up to in our childhood? We used to. I was brought up in back of Longbridge in Birmingham, where the car, the old car factory was. And I can remember my mum, one of six single parents, six kids. My mum would say in the morning, it'd be first thing in the morning, she'd say, "Make sure you're back for tea. Make sure you're back for tea." My mum would be viewed as a poor parent, but we were all out there together. And we used to go to the places where we weren't supposed to go, up the allotments where there was a river. We used to get up to all kinds of monkey business up there. Fire building, den building, climbing trees, making boats, getting into trouble, getting ourselves out of trouble, learning how to take care for the little ones, learning when to stand up for yourself, learning when to run away because the big boys were coming. You know, those kind of life skills that we all, I guess you all would have had. Some fantastic research done about the closing world of children, where if you say to grandparents, where were you allowed to go when you were 5 or 6? 8 miles. When would people of my generation like to go? 3 or 4 miles. Where's this generation? It's like the corner shop. if you're lucky, many children, not even the back garden. They're watched all the time because there's an anxiety there. Although the evidence is that children aren't less safe than they were, but that it's very visible and we're more anxious about it. So how do we provide them with opportunities to get out of your sight and to learn things for themselves, build that resilience up that's so important? That's why I like den buildings so much. But also, that leads me to the next bit, which is why the outdoors is so important. You know, there's a lot of evidence to say that when children are out of doors, the adults that are with them are freer with them somehow. They give the children more autonomy, more freedom. I know there's parameters, but something happens outdoors. And there's the constant change of outdoors. We have weather in England, don't we? Big time. And I keep saying to practitioners, when you've got weather happening, like snow or wind or rain, that's the best time to be out of doors because children are learning about, you know, differences and how to deal with all of that. That's not the time to keep indoors. And the Swedes have this wonderful thing. There's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing. You know, they help their children learn how to deal with the weather. So they get minus 30, they're out there, but they've got boots and snugglies and, you know, that outdoors is really, really important. But there's another reason for me why it's important. And I have to say, I'm not a religious person, but I do have a sense of a spiritual life. You know, that awe and wonder bit. And when I feel that, and I don't know about you, but when I'm in touch, when I think, God, this world is just so brilliant and so fantastic, mostly I get that sense when I'm outdoors. I was walking this last spring, I was walking down, I'm a Birmingham city girl, walking down the roads. There's a lot of trees in Birmingham, actually. And there was this fantastic cherry blossom tree. And I was just walking along, and it was a beautiful spring morning, and the sky was blue. And this cherry tree had the blossomiest blossom you've ever seen. It was almost like pink candles. You know that vivid pink? And it was against this blue sky. And then just at that moment, this bird started to sing. And I just was pulled up short, and I thought, wow, something lifted me. I thought, isn't this magical? Isn't this... I was lifted somewhere beyond myself. And it's a bit Wordsworth, you know, nature teaches you, or it lifts you somewhere. But I think spiritual development often happens in the natural world. And remember, I'm not talking about forest schools or anything. This was in the middle of inner city Birmingham. Okay, so the outdoors takes you somewhere else. It lifts the lid off the containment that gives you a sense of something... Do you think I'm mad, or are you with me? Okay, so it's not, we sometimes say, oh, outdoors is important for physical development or science, and they can do that. It's deep stuff, this. And if we don't give children the chance to be out there and experience that, when the forces of wind are raging, that does something else as well, doesn't it? You know, you're learning about this big world out there. Anyway, I won't go on. But outdoor stuff, we've got work to do there. And the last one is about, it links with the individual stuff, knowing your children as individuals and being really skilled at scaffolding and supporting them, not in an instructional or programmed way, but going with recognising what that child's individual talents and skills are, and they all have them. They may not be the talents and skills you'd hope for, but they've got them. And working with that in a very positive developmental way. Not looking for what they can't do, looking for what they can do, and then working progressively and affirmatively with that. So how are you observing your children? And there's some really good stuff on observation-based practice now going on. I think we're getting good at that now. Still some way to go, but we're getting better at that. And using that evidence to plan and inform next steps and go with that. So that individualised bit and really seeing children from the beginning as on a learning journey themselves, and we being their privileged companions as they walk through their early years. It is a privilege, isn't it? An absolute privilege to have that possibility to be alongside those children and the gift of the joy they bring to lives. And I don't mean that in a in a namby-pamby way. I mean it in a deeply serious way. It's the best job in the world. Best job in the world. So those are the things I'm looking for, and when I go into setting, that I would make judgments about that setting delivering something magic, some magical dust on that child that gives them something that they wouldn't have had without you. I'm going to stop there. What I want to do now is to open up for a conversation, and maybe I'll go back to say, we've got in England, I think, some settings that do that in spades, that do that really well. We've got world-class services around. How do we use that capacity? How do we build on that capacity? How do you do that in your work to get that to all children and all communities? How do we give them access? And what's getting in the way of that? And, you know, what's the steps in the journey around? Where would you start? What you know? What work would you be doing? Yeah.
Thank you for that. It was really inspirational. You were talking about practitioners, and actually, you were talking about children's well-being. And I was thinking actually about, and you talked about practitioners' well-being. And I was remembering a few years ago, I took some practitioners with me to Finland to look at their. It was actually after the OECD report about children's well-being, and. And one of the things we asked, we visited lots and lots of different types of settings, and one of the questions we asked the practitioners was about why are you so good at creating this well-being, sense of well-being in your provision? And there was a sense of well-being. And it was very, I mean, what we noted, of course, although it was unhurried, there wasn't, it wasn't that there were different activities, but it was kind of unhurried, and there was this real focus on children's emotional and social development. Mm. A very, very strong focus on that. In fact, they were less well resourced in lots of cases than some of our provision. Mm. But one of the key things that I came back with was the well being of practitioners. Mm. They strongly focused on well being of practitioners because their view is that if practitioners don't have a sense of well being, they won't be able to communicate that sense to the children because they themselves will be feeling stressed, rushed, hurried. Yeah. You know, and so that was you know, something we came back with. Mm. And actually the people from the nurseries and the children's centres that came with me as well came back with and tried to kind of create some spaces for the practitioners.
You're absolutely right. And I think some of that is about the sense that they're letting the children and the practitioners do their job for that, those children, not worrying about what are you doing to prepare them for the next stage. That's the hurried child or the school readiness stuff. It's about let's give them the best time now. Let's have the best time with them now. And that's the best preparation for what comes next. They also highly train their practitioners, so they trust them. And a lot of this is about a professional base that's got the skill base and then let them get on with it. But you've got to have trained staff to do that.
Mm. Just to carry on from that, is the evidence collecting that we've had. Yeah. Our authority seems to look for them. I don't know whether this is common, but it's that's what brings the staff down. Mm. It's the ongoing assessments, observations, which is great, but the amount of stuff that has to be collected for moderation. It's as if the teachers and the staff are just not trusted in their judgments, and we find that this is a huge issue, which I don't know whether that is across the national.
Go on, yeah.
This moderation is a fantastic opportunity for professional development, isn't it? It shouldn't be seen as something that's thrust down upon you, but something that actually people want to engage in because it provides opportunities to actually really look at children and their developments and their interests and their fascinations, and if it's done in that way, I think it could be the best professional development.
Can I make a point here? Because I think there's two different things going on. There's the assessment bit, and good practitioners are assessing continually. Like, whenever you're in any interaction or conversation, to make that work, you're constantly making judgments about where I am, I fitting in. So that's, I think somebody was saying good practitioners are making millions of assessments every day, every interaction. So let's separate assessment, which is how you then know what the next, you know, where the child is and what the child can do and all that. Assessment is part and parcel of being a practitioner, knowing who this child is, where you can't work with the child unless you're doing that. The issue is around documentation and what is perceived as counting as evidence, and this sense that you need to evidence everything in a documented form. By the way, that's a myth. Nowhere does it say that you are required to document and evidence every aspect of children's learning and development. Now, I'm not... Documentation, if you're documenting, all what you're doing is just capturing and document the key things that really matter that enable you to evidence children's... But I think it's gone mad, you know, and I hope, again, the Tikau Review will look, and I'm optimistic that it will, to say, you know, there are some core things that we do need to document and track and evidence that children are developing well, because we need it for accountability and we need it to plan for next stages. And I think those things roughly focus on the PSED stuff and the communication language stuff. I'm less worried about the literacy, but that's me. But I do want to know if the child's communicating well and using their language as well. I do want to know if they're sociable. And I want to be able to evidence that my work is working hard at that. I'm not so worried about whether they can count to 10 or whether they can, you know... Those things, I think, if the child's communicating and experience, they'll get that, and they can get it later or earlier. But I know those things, if they don't get it earlier, they're lost. They're in real trouble. I am a great fan of assessment. I think we've got to get... only document the things that really matter and only document things in a way that you can use to help you with that child. Because I think we sometimes are documenting, recording things, not for us as practitioners to help inform what we do, but for something out there that is like, Ofsted need it or the local authority need it. And when you go and talk to Ofsted, they say, no, we don't. Mm-hmm. No, as long as you can... No, as long as you know where children are, you're planning well and you're using that evidence as base there. So we need to have enough evidence, but we need to be clear about what evidence and how, you know, and the purpose of it. But I do think that we've got to myth bust, I suppose, about how much is expected and what you've got to document and the way that you've got to... Because I think it's just gone... What we've got is kind of profile, EYFSB profile stuff, modelled down earlier. And it was never designed for that. It was an end-of-stage summative thing. And maybe even then it was too detailed from what we now know about what really matters. But, you know, if you start to model that down for a two-year-old or a three-year-old, which is what's happening, and what you then get is a whole list of items like a checklist that children are checked off. Why are we doing that? What for? What use is going to be made of it? And if you can't answer those questions, don't do it. The only statutory assessment, by the way, is the profile at the end of stage. So anything else that's before that is because somebody somewhere said you must do that. And I think we've got to reclaim that back again. So what do I need to evidence to do my work and to show that the key things of development are going on well in our children? And everything else, you know, is secondary to that. You know, I'd rather you be using that time to interact with the children. Okay. So, you know, it's about, you know, a balance and being more clear about what you need to document, how often and for what purpose. And if you can't... say there's a utility for the child and the family and yourselves, don't do it.
Yeah. You document and evidence everything with the child. There's every moment spent away sitting at a desk writing a summative assessment is time spent away from the child. Mm. So we involve the children in their learning journey. And they will often, if they've done a picture, for example, then they'll come into the office and ask for it to be photocopied. So they've got one to take home and one to go in their learning journey. Mm. And that's the child's choice.
Yeah.
That is inclusive. Yeah. So everything that we document on a child is actually done with the child as a part of a, you know, they stick the pictures in, they, you know, read the...
And then it's part of your daily life with the child. It's, you know, it isn't assessment and record evidence. It isn't, you know, an event that happens or something that's away from that. You're doing it as part and parcel.
Reading the observations with the child. The child is recalling what he did and reflecting on it himself.
Yeah.
So it is, you know, literally alongside the child.
Brilliant.
Not done away from the child.
And I'd include the parents should be also part of that, bringing what the child's doing at home and their experiences.
That exactly happens as well. Yeah. Parents bring in the information and it's shared. They can take the learning journey away. Mm. But I agree with the lady that that is about the practitioners, making them happy and healthy.
Mm.
And the only way you can do that is by having enough of them so they're not put under pressure to get from one end of the day to the next with all the tasks completed.
Yeah. You know that note that somebody was talking this morning at this conference about compliance anxiety in staff, that the stress comes because there's this pressure that you've got to comply to a format or an expectation that somebody else has to get it right, and you've lost confidence in yourself.
Assessment, health and safety, and all the legislative documentation.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, so much of their day is made up of, you know, completing, you know, what's the temperature of the fridge like, you know.
But we've got to be careful not to polarise that, you know, there's too much and therefore let's get rid of it all. It's about how much and the way to do it. You've got good practice, it sounds like, in your settings, and that's great.
Be able to be there with the children so that I can make my other, you know, the existing staff I have feel more comfortable that it's not a struggle to get to 6 o'clock. But I can't afford to employ anybody else because there's not enough money in the industry.
No. And that's where the whole thing about training, ratios, terms and conditions and all of those things, you know, you're coming back again to the staff and Liz's point about the well-being of the staff.
Totally
because
they're going to build the relationship with the parents.
But
to spend that extra 10 minutes talking to the parent, they're not sort of, you know,
it's a job and I've got to run out the door.
The energy to do
it. It is investment and it is numbers, but I think it's more than that. It's about a culture and a climate. And I'm coming back to who leads that. It's the leaders. How do you give people a sense that their contribution that they're making, whatever role they have in your setting, is really valued, really expected? How do you give them... And I'm not just about trading on people's goodwill here, but it's about a sense of community and value and that you're part of something very special that's going on and you make a special contribution to that. And the teamness of that, you know, the old team around the job, it's about value, respect, which gives a climate of well-being and living well together. I'm going to go back to an old-fashioned word that I remember one politician scoffing at me about, and it's vocation. I think most people come into work with children and families not because it's, you know, they're going to make money or, you know, they come in because they really want to make a difference and they enjoy children's company and they care about their work. That's what vocation is about. Working with young children is... let me finish, though. Of course, they can't... I think one of the things that's happened is the sector, the goodwill of the sector, if you like, has been traded at long. And I think as we professionalise that, and I think that's happening, this idea that people need to be rewarded for a skilled job. We're still a country, by the way, that plays its cleaners and its dustmen more than you pay somebody who works, you know, the minimum wage stuff and below. Yeah. It's not good enough, you know. So that's got to change.
Who are trying to live independently of their
parents. I agree. So that's a societal issue about saying the investment and the acknowledgement of that skill base. If you are saying it's a skill job and you've got to, then there are consequences that come with that. And this is work that the sector's still got to do, to put ourselves alongside other professionals with the same value. By the way, I'll give you I was talking to an economist this week who said that the added value of a nursery nurse, for every pound you spend on a nursery word, it pays back society 10 times, okay? For every pound you pay a banker, now this is a cheap joke, isn't it? It costs society £100. And it's an interesting thing, but you know what I'm saying is, what do we value and where's the value? And I do think that's changing. I do think our society is beginning to recognise that the work early childhood professionals do has value for society, economic value for society. And it's a, you know, that's a journey for our society to go on to shift that perception.
But the perception has to be shifted from a vocation to an actual profession.
Yeah, but I don't want to lose the vocation bit either, because it isn't just a job that you're paid for and you go to and you because part of the specialness of our work is that it is that people need to feel, and a child needs to feel, that when you've gone away from them at the end of the day, they've been in your head a bit. You know, you've thought about them overnight, and, you know, that's what I mean about a vocation. And you display that in lots of little ways. I was in a setting recently that had a little box for every child, and, you know, the key person. Every day, the key person put a little gift in that box. And when I say gift, it could be a leaf, or it could be the toy they played with the day before, or it could be a little note. Where did the children go first thing the next morning? Every day, they went straight to their box. And it was, I know I've been in that person's head before I've come in there. It's that kind of, that's what I mean. Somebody who is there because they enjoy the job, not just because there's a wage packet at the end of the day. So, you know, of course the wage
packet. Anybody who lives for a wage packet at the end of the day.
No. Well, that's good. Because actually, you know, there are some people who may have come into the profession because they didn't get on the hairdressing course. Mm. You know. And it happens, you know, they don't really want to be there. You know, they don't really want to be there. Mm. And that's got to change, I think. Mm. But I'm not ducking the fundamental point you make, absolutely. We've work to do there. Sorry, you were going to say something.
I was going to come back to the, what are you looking at when you're actually doing your observations? And we took a group of practitioners in early years, professionals, to Sweden to look at a gender school there. It was quite challenging for them.
A gender school?
A gender school.
Can you just explain that to the group?
Yes, they were looking... This particular school looks at trying to equalise the boys and girls so there's a kind of equality and yet keep the individual side. But
okay.
What the boys were interested in, what the girls were interested in. And it was outdoors a lot of it, as you say. And the only rule that the children had to stick to, because there were no boundaries, it was open countryside, was that all the staff, when they were outside, wore a red jacket. And they wanted to look at what the boys and the girls were doing outside and how they could facilitate their learning. And so they asked one, this is what the practitioners saw. The boys and the girls were told they could run as far as they could, but obviously they had to keep somebody with a red jacket in sight. They could just couldn't go beyond having somebody there. And what they found was that the boys just ran.
Yeah.
But the girls stopped. Oh, that's a nice plant. They were inspecting things. Yeah. So the next day they swapped it round, what the children did. They looked at what had been happening, and then they swapped it round. So the boys had to look nature and stop and look, whereas the girls were told to run.
Interesting.
Know, I think it's that kind of back to the awe and wonder and the inspiration.
But also the reflectiveness of that. So they've looked at what's gone on and said, what can I do with that? Let's play around with that a little bit. Let's try something new out and see what is the result of that. And that's a lovely example of that. By the way, some of the most interesting pedagogic work going on at the moment, and we're seeing it in our part of a research community, some of the most interesting framing is around outdoor play at the moment. Really interesting work going on about what children do when they're outdoors. Being led, by the way, by the Northern Europeans, which is quite interesting. But, you know, there's some really interesting stuff coming out of that. So that's when I come back to this. How do we communicate that back to the sector? How do we let them get the sense of that kind of debate about when they're outdoors, what's going on there?
Yeah.
Sorry, just a little anecdote of this, but my children were brought up in Sweden. They went through the Swedish school system. And my daughter and I went back recently for a visit. And I said, oh, look, because every block of flats has a play area and rocks and swings and all the rest of it. You can always see what your children are doing.
And I said, oh, look, there's the rocks you used to play. And she said, no, I didn't. I used to play around there in those rocks.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, 30 years later.
Yeah,
you know.
And she could remember it. Yes. Yeah. I mean, the last thing I want to say, because it's time and we've overrun, but there is some fantastic, and I think we should look to Sweden and France and Italy and all these places, but I also think we should know that in England now there is some brilliant work going on, you know, and it's how we get the brilliant work that's developed in our culture out. You know, we don't have to do these trips. We can, you know, we've got to get better at disseminating this, and I'm interested in Sweden and that, because I think you learn more when you've looked outside, you learn more about yourself, don't you? But there is some really great stuff going on here in all communities, and it's how we blow on that and get that more disseminated. Sally, did you want to say something? That was empty, don't worry.
I was just thinking about how you actually disseminate. I think it starts off with a very believed teacher in children's centres, especially when you've got some really strong practice, and how they can actually go out and work with their linked settings and sort of model practice and bring people in. And developing local networks where people can come together to share what they're doing from lots of different agencies and sectors as well. And I think once that's established, then you can actually move out to even to sort of this era and things like that. But it's about the nub of it. It's practitioners who actually really find children fascinating and who are supported in seeing themselves as researchful practitioners.
Yeah.
It sounds corny, but it is. It's about that constant observation, reflection, and then changing your practice and constantly developing. And that's what keeps people alive.
Yeah, and it's that communities of practice bit. Let's experiment a little bit like that. Let's try something out. Let's see if it works, and then let's have a dialogue about that. That's work the sector's got to do to create communities of learning, communities of practice around, where that kind of bottom-up kind of knowledge is developed and shared. A big piece of work with this early childhood research group that I'm part of. And by research, I'm not talking about high-flowing academic universities. I'm talking about regular child mind things, really looking and inquiring about what's going on a daily basis and getting fascinated by that and saying, well, what would happen if I did this? And what would happen if I did that? And then looking at that and then talking about it. It's that kind of climate that I think Sally's talking about.
Exactly what you're trying to say, and actually modelling that sort of way of being for the children as well, because you want them to be
curious, and it, yes, curious. Yeah. I think it's time to go home. Whatever you do tonight, enjoy yourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you.